Bless Cats, and Jeff Simmons, heard Thursdays at 5 p.m. It is now 6 p.m. Stay tuned for the WBAI Evening News with Paul DiRienzo coming up.
And we'll start with Alana Levinson with some of today's headlines.
Beginning with the vote recount in Florida. Unofficial results show the margin between U.S. Senator Bill Nelson and Governor Rick Scott is still thin enough to trigger a second review. State law requires a hand recount of races with margins of 0.25 percentage points or less. Counties have until Sunday to inspect the ballots that did not record a vote when put through the machines. Those ballots are re-examined to see whether the voter skipped the race or marked the ballot in a way that the machines cannot read but can be deciphered. The election is to be certified on Tuesday. And in Washington today, Donald Trump's ally Kevin McCarthy has been selected as House Minority Leader after severe Republican losses. McCarthy says, "We serve in a divided government in a divided country." He says his next goal is to make sure Republicans win back the majority.
We know the Democrats have a plan. They want to disrupt, they want to try to impeach, and they want to stall what achievements we've been able to move forward. But we know America is too great for such a small vision. We took a beating inside the suburban areas. We're going to have to work harder. I think our message is going to have to be clearer. Our ideas are going to have to be stronger. We realize that, and we will work towards that effort.
McCarthy said Republicans will try to recruit more women and focus on diversity going forward. The House went from 23 female GOP lawmakers to 13. In other news, today, New York Attorney General Barbara Underwood, with 12 other attorney generals, demanded that the Trump administration end its policy that separates immigrant families in federal detention facilities. She says, "These unaccompanied children have already faced profound trauma. It's unconscionable that the Trump administration is further prolonging their detention and unnecessarily keeping them separated from families or sponsors." She wants the federal government to immediately reverse the policy. The current policy requires prospective sponsors of unaccompanied migrant children and their entire households to submit to fingerprinting and background checks, which are automatically shared with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Underwood says the policy imposes unjustified burdens in the sponsorship process and leaves many prospective sponsors with an untenable choice of either leaving children in federal custody or coming forward and possibly exposing themselves or loved ones to immigration enforcement. And Mayor de Blasio today says the Trump administration's public charge proposal that would punish immigrants for using public benefits like food stamps would harm up to 475,000 immigrant New Yorkers. His administration's analysis finds that the public charge proposal would cost New York City at least $420 million every year. It would also discourage immigrant families from participating in critical safety net programs out of fear of consequences to their immigration status. With decreased enrollment, the city will suffer annual losses to food and cash assistance programs in the millions. In other news, Facebook released a report on community standards today. It says it's making progress on detecting hate speech, graphic violence, and other violations of its rules, even before users see and report them. It says it has doubled the amount of hate speech it detected compared with 6 months ago. The company also said it disabled more than 1.5 billion fake accounts in the latest 6 month period, compared with 1.3 billion during the previous 6 months. Facebook has faced accusations of bias against conservatives, something it denies, as well as criticism that it does not go far enough in removing hateful content. In international news, a UN Committee on Human Rights has approved a resolution urging Iran to stop its widespread use of arbitrary detention and expressing serious concern over its alarmingly high use of the death penalty. The resolution also strongly urges Iran to eliminate discrimination against women in law and expresses serious concern about ongoing severe limitations and restrictions on the right to freedom of thought, conscience, religion, or belief. Also today, British Prime Minister and Conservative Party leader Theresa May defied mounting calls to quit or change course over Britain's withdrawal from the European Union. She warned that abandoning her Brexit plan would plunge the country into deep and grave uncertainty.
Leadership is about taking the right decisions, not the easy ones. As Prime Minister, my job is to bring back a deal that delivers on the vote of the British people, that does that by ending free movement, all the things I raised in my statement, ending free movement, ensuring we're not sending vast annual sums to the EU any longer, ending the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice, but also protects jobs and protects people's livelihoods, protects our security, protects the union of the United Kingdom. I believe that this is a deal which does deliver that, which is in the national interest. And am I going to see this through? Yes.
May's speech this evening was in reaction to the resignation of two cabinet ministers and a call for her replacement by some lawmakers from her own party. The crisis threatens to destroy the Brexit agreement, unseat the prime minister, and send the UK hurtling toward the EU exit without a plan.
Okay. Thanks, Ilana, and you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. And in the Florida Senate race, the latest on the election recount, Florida's Secretary of State has ordered a manual recount in the state's hotly contested U.S. Senate race. Department of State spokeswoman Sarah Revel said in a news release Thursday evening that unofficial returns from a machine recount had triggered a second recount in the Senate race and the state agricultural commissioner's race. The release said the results of the manual recount are due by noon on Sunday. Unofficial recount results on the Secretary of State's website show Republican Governor Rick Scott with a 0.15 percentage point lead over Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator Bill Nelson. State law requires a hand recount of races with margins of 0.25 percentage points or less. And in world news, Brazil's president-elect, Jair Bolsonaro, has chosen a new foreign minister who believes climate change is part of a plot by cultural Marxists to stifle Western economies and promote the growth of China. It's a stunning rebuke to Brazil's decades of leadership in environmental movements key to combating the cause of global climate change. The new minister, Ernesto Araújo, was until now a minor official, his social media posts ranting about the criminalization of red meat, oil, and heterosexual sex. He will become the top diplomat of South America's biggest nation with 200 million people and the vast Amazon rainforest. His appointment, confirmed by Bolsonaro on Wednesday, is likely to send a chill through the global climate movement. In his blog, Araújo states, his goal is to help Brazil and the world liberate themselves from globalist ideology, which he sees as anti-Christian. He also claims the center-left Workers' Party in Brazil was criminalizing sex and reproduction, saying that all heterosexual intercourse is rape and every baby is a risk to the planet as it will increase carbon emissions. All patently false statements. Bolsonaro is intent on opening up the Amazon to the farmers, miners, and construction companies that supported his campaign. His pick as agriculture minister is the head of the farming lobby, Teresa Cristina Diaz, who conservationists have nicknamed the Muse of Poison due to her enthusiastic support for relaxing controls on agrotoxins. Reportedly, there has been a sharp rise in deforestation during the election campaign, suggesting protections for nature and indigenous land already weakening. The October runoff gave Bolsonaro nearly 58 million votes and a solid victory over his opponent, former Sao Paulo mayor Fernando Haddad. The vote was seen as a rebuke to the ruling Workers' Party, which had come under withering criticism from the right, including allegations of manufactured fake news that swayed public opinion. Alexander Martin is a specialist in U.S. policy towards Latin America. He says Bolsonaro's victory is a frightening echo of Brazil's past when dictatorial generals ruled with an iron fist.
It really harkens back to, well, the Brazilian military dictatorship from 1964 to 1985, which operated very much within a Cold War paradigm of going after anything that appeared to be even remotely associated with communism, and jailing people, torturing them, executing them, forcing them into exile as a part of state policy. This is what he has literally threatened to do. We'll have to see whether there exists really sufficient checks and balances in the Brazilian institutional system to prevent him from carrying out all these threats. A lot of people are skeptical.
How did we get here? There was a Lula, we had a left-wing government, and now we have a person who's a happy warrior against democracy in power. How do we get to that point?
Part of this is a backlash, actually, to the progressive policies of Lula and the Workers' Party. they were in power from 2003 until 2016, Lula da Silva, and then his successor, the first female president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, who was removed in what many people say amounts to a coup, an impeachment based on false charges against her that were dismissed by the judicial authorities, and she was replaced by a hard right government. It was really the beginning of the shift to the far right that we saw in Brazil that started after Dilma's impeachment, President Dilma's impeachment in 2016, and has been reinforced now with the election of Jair Bolsonaro. But certainly a lot of Brazil's middle classes that didn't benefit as much from the anti-poverty programs and affirmative action programs under the Lula and Dilma governments have been in their majority supportive of Jair Bolsonaro. It's sort of a racist and classist backlash, you could say. And then there are other factors that have come into play as well, including a very effective misinformation campaign, a fake news campaign that was carried out apparently with illicit funding from Brazilian business people that put millions of dollars into a sophisticated sort of Cambridge Analytica-style targeted campaign that filled social media in Brazil, and particularly in strategic areas electorally, with completely fake news. None of the opponents, certainly the Workers' Party, they were not able to really respond to this. To this day, it appears that many of the receivers of this fake news still believe it, and we're talking about very far-fetched lies that have sort of an ideological side to them, where they claim that the opponent from the Workers' Party, who lost to Jair Bolsonaro, they claim that he planned on putting into place a communist education system and to also teach young people pedophilia and force them to be homosexuals and so on and so forth. So appealing to sort of the worst base instincts of Brazilian conservatives, and very effectively. And they believe this. Many of them continue to believe it. So that was a huge problem. And there are other factors. There was a massive corruption scandal referred to as the car wash scandal that involved kickbacks from contractors to the state oil company, Petrobras, kickbacks to politicians. And that appears to have involved really all of the political class, all of the major political parties, certainly, including the Workers' Party and other parties. Within this broader investigation, which brought down a number of politicians, there was one judge who sort of was on a mission to go after the Workers' Party in particular, and within the Workers' Party to go after President Lula da Silva. His name is Sergio Moro, and he really waged a campaign, very politicized sort of judicial proceedings and investigation with all sorts of violations to President Lula's due process rights. And ultimately, he succeeded in sentencing Lula da Silva to jail for 12 years on really extraordinarily weak charges of, you know, that supposedly he was going to receive a bribe, but he didn't. And it all sort of rests on the testimony of one individual who changed his initial testimony and changed it in order to incriminate President Lula and saw his sentence subsequently lightened by 70%. This was a convicted criminal who'd sort of plea bargained this testimony. And that is the only thing that you have against former President Lula da Silva and that has led to him being locked away for 12 years. And effectively by removing Lula da Silva from the political equation, by preventing him from running in these elections, that paved the way for the victory of Jair Bolsonaro. Lula da Silva was actually the most popular political figure in Brazil. He continues to be. And polls showed he was going to run for president in these elections, and polls showed that he would have easily won against Jair Bolsonaro or any other candidate, possibly in the first round of the elections. So by removing him from the equation, this sort of activist judge, Sergio Moro, paved the way for Bolsonaro, and it's interesting to note that he was just offered the job of justice minister, Sergio Moro, under the future government of Jair Bolsonaro, and he has accepted that job. So it's led to a major career advancement, this mission, this crusade that he's carried out against the Workers' Party and Lula da Silva through the jailing of Lula da Silva.
Alexander Martin is a specialist in U.S. policy towards Latin America. He says that thousands have been protesting Brazil's new president, and he expects more protests in the future. And in related news, Brazil's former health minister says millions of Brazilians may be left without access to health care after Cuba said it would recall thousands of doctors who provided services in underserved Brazilian towns. The Cuban doctors are located in nearly 3,000 cities and towns, including 1,700 without any doctors at all. The Cuban government shares its world-renowned free health care system with over 60 countries. The fees are standard and reflect the volunteer nature of much of the medical help Cuban doctors provide. Doctors who work in the poorest areas, the former health minister said, are not just thinking about the money. And in national news, despite laws in the majority of states allowing pharmacies to dispense the opioid overdose reversal antidote naloxone without a prescription, new research indicates that it's still not simple to buy the drug at pharmacies. Naloxone is a drug that binds to opioid receptors in the brain in place of opioid drugs. Within 2 to 5 minutes after the medication is administered, it can reverse a life-threatening overdose. Last year, the CDC reported 72,000 Americans died of drug overdoses, nearly 50,000 of those deaths attributable to opioids. But the Journal of the American Medical Association says it's still not simple to buy the drug at pharmacies. More than 40 states have Good Samaritan laws that allow people to possess the anti-overdose drugs. And in April, Surgeon General Dr. Jerome Adams recommended more Americans learn how to use naloxone and carry it with them. But the JAMA report says only a quarter of pharmacies called would provide naloxone in California, although the drug is available over the counter in the state. In New York City, where 1,374 people died of drug overdoses in 2016, the health department's I Saved a Life naloxone awareness campaign directed New Yorkers to more than 700 pharmacies in the city that dispense naloxone without a prescription. But one place in New York where naloxone is not available are the state's jails and prisons. Inmates in New York cannot get any of the drugs usually made available to addicts on the outside. On Wednesday, the State Assembly Committee on Corrections, Alcoholism, and Drug Abuse and Health held a hearing on the issue. Assembly member Linda Rosenthal was joined by drug policy activists and treatment providers. They were calling for access to medication-assisted treatment, known as MAT, in all New York jails and hospitals. A spokesperson for the Drug Policy Alliance tells WBAI that when a person enters jail with a drug habit, they have a 40 times greater chance of overdose.
New York State correctional facilities, including jails and prisons, do not have adequate treatment options for people who have substance use disorder, and specifically people who experience opioid use disorder don't readily have access to methadone and buprenorphine, two medications considered to be the gold standard of treatment. Because of that, the rates of fatal overdose is especially high within this population. Researchers have suggested or presented data to suggest that people who are justice involved or formerly incarcerated have a 40 times higher rate of overdose than people in the general population. And that's because once they are incarcerated and not given adequate treatment, then they are then placed in the community. And if they do continue to use, and relapse is a condition of substance use, and if they continue to use, and their tolerance decreases, they can experience a fatal overdose in that period. And the most dangerous and vulnerable period is the 2 weeks following incarceration.
King says the Department of Correctional Services provides talking therapy, such as Narcotics Anonymous, but no life-saving drugs.
They will say that they offer cognitive and behavioral treatment, so AA, NA, group therapy, but those routinely aren't accessible. They have a shortest treatment slot, and they don't allow the use of methadone or buprenorphine for folks who are currently incarcerated. They are launching several pilot programs, but those are primarily targeting people who are parole violators who can choose to enter a Vivitrol program for parole violators, and they'll get access to Vivitrol. Vivitrol is a injectable form of naltrexone. It is an opioid antagonist therapy, so it has the same sort of principles behind it. It attaches to your opioid receptors and blocks the opioids from bonding if you use the opioid, and it saves off withdrawal and craving while it's in your system, but it only lasts 28 days. It's not widely researched. It's not as effective as the other medications that do have more research and evidence behind them, but that's mostly what you will likely find in the justice setting, because Alkermes, the pharmaceutical company that makes Vivitrol, has targeted correctional staff and promoted that drug. So right, it's a shot, it's $1,000 a shot, but right now correctional facilities are getting it for free from Alkermes because they're providing it to the reentrant population.
Dionne King is a spokesperson for the Drug Policy Alliance. She says by providing effective treatment and quality reentry services to individuals while incarcerated, New York can potentially reduce the rate of fatal overdose, spending less on incarceration and emergency health care. And finally, flu season is coming. For most, it's a couple of miserable days off from work. For millions, the pinch of a flu shot. But 100 years ago today marks one of the worst disease pandemics in world history. The influenza spread in a matter of weeks around the globe in the aftermath of World War I, the devastating and deadly illness causing panic equal to the war itself. Although today, the epidemic is barely remembered. John Barry is author of The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. He says there's no reason a similar catastrophe couldn't happen today.
The peak of it was almost exactly 100 years ago to the day. Killed between 50 and 100 million people. Just for population, that would be between 225 million and 450 million people today. Most of those people died within a period of about 3 months. And probably two-thirds of the dead were people who were otherwise healthy, young adults, age from like 18 to 40, 45, something like that, which is one of the great mysteries. Normally, influenza kills infants and the elderly. In 1918, the elderly escaped almost untouched. The excess mortality, 95-99% even, of the excess mortality was people under the age of 65. So it was an unusual pandemic. It actually wasn't the only highly lethal influenza pandemic that's occurred in history. There's one in 1580 that made it from Asia to Africa to Europe and even to the Americas. There was another one in 1688 across much of Europe that crossed the ocean to the Americas. Smallpox was the biggest killer of Native Americans in both North and South America, but influenza came in second. There was a first wave of disease that occurred in the spring, and just like the 2009 pandemic, the disease was hit or miss. A few cities were hit somewhat hard. Other cities were skipped entirely. Los Angeles didn't have a single influenza death in the spring of 1918. New York had hundreds die. Chicago was hit. But the spring wave was still relatively mild, not something that attracted much attention at the time, or what did attract attention, but it didn't seem like a lethal threat at the time. And then the virus seemed to, and nobody quite understands how the virus changed genetically. It seems very similar, the spring and fall viruses, but for some reason, the fall virus became lethal. The overall case mortality in the West was probably only about 2%. In some subgroups, like pregnant women, it was vastly higher. Like there are studies that say it's different studies from 23% to 71% case mortality for pregnant women. It would start with an attack like ordinary influenza that everybody is familiar with. You never knew whether you were going to have just an ordinary attack or whether you were going to get really, really sick. Some people died within 24 hours. Some of the symptoms were horrific. Unlike any other influenza, you could bleed not only from your nose and mouth, but actually from your eyes and ears. Pretty scary. People were turning so dark blue from lack of oxygen that doctors were actually saying they had difficulty distinguishing African-American soldiers from white soldiers. The context in terms of a public health response, the government, the U.S. government wanted everything to be positive. Every news item was always supposed to be positive. Keep morale up, get morale up. As a result, the public health authorities, both national and local, lied. They said, this is ordinary influenza by another name. You have nothing to fear if ordinary precautions are taken. Nothing was done to interfere with the morale of the community. Statements like that. For example, in Philadelphia, which was one of the hardest hit cities, when they finally banned all public gatherings, canceled all sporting events, closed all schools, closed all saloons, closed vaudeville theaters, closed movie theaters, banned churches from having services, one of the newspapers actually said, you have no reason for alarm. This is not a public health measure. You know, I mean, so given the horrific symptoms, given that people are dying all around you, given that the government is finally closing everything down, you know, how stupid did they think people were? You know, people could figure out pretty rapidly that they were being lied to. And I think that that definitely increased the amount of fear that was extant throughout the country.
The defense industry, as it's called.
And 100 years ago today, the world was reeling in terror from a disease epidemic that seemed to mark the end of civilization itself. While scientists tried to understand what was happening, the pandemic petered out of its own accord. And that's some of the news for Thursday, November 15th, 2018. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Alana Levinson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.
November is National Native American Heritage Month, so come spend the evening with me, John Kane, from WBAI's Let's Talk on Thursday, November 29th at 7 p.m. I will be hosting a free screening of Even the Rain, a powerful film that demonstrates the brutal acts committed against Native peoples by Columbus and his men, and the violence and exploitation that continues even now. This Spanish language film layers history, racism, and the plight of indigenous peoples in a unique plot that recreates the past and strikes at the issues of today. And I want to extend a special invitation to our Spanish-speaking friends to help us catch all the nuances of the film. So come celebrate our special month by joining us at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. That's Thursday, November 29th, 7 p.m. for Even the Rain.
Hi. This is Sean Rhodes from the award-winning Midnight Ravers. On Sunday, November 18th, from 3 to 9 p.m., WBAI will broadcast Consabor Latino's annual Salsa Explosion fundraiser live from SOB's, which is located at 204 Varick Street, corner of Varick and Houston Street in the West Village. The show will feature many world-renowned musicians, and special Consabor Latino Lifetime Achievement Awards will be presented. If you can't make it to SOB's, you can go online at give2wbai.org and make your donation that way during the program. So be sure to tune in and show your support. Again, that's Sunday, November 18th from 3 to 9 p.m. only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
New York's David Goodman, president of the Andrew Goodman Foundation, was in Washington, D.C. for the Poor People's Campaign.
The same horrible strain of racism expressed by Jim Crow and the KKK during Freedom Summer is again showing its ugly head in policies coming out of extremist state legislatures and governors. And just like the past, they are creating new laws and practices that restrict access to needs of the poor, like health insurance, and restricting access to the ballot box. They're connected. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court gave its blessing to the Ohio's blatant voter suppression scheme. That's why we need a national call for moral revival. I can call all of us, particularly young people across the country, to carry on the legacy of Andrew Goodman, James Taney, and Michael Schwerner. We stand together with the young people today and all of us. Forward together.
Not one step back.
Thank you.
David Goodman, and you're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York.